The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Joe McPeak. I'm the Associate Director of the Free Library. And as you saw in the great video that just aired, the Free Library is dedicated to, and this is our mission, advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity at its 54 libraries throughout the greater Philadelphia area. And personally, I'm so proud of the work that our talented librarians and staff do every day to ensure equal access to information for all Philadelphians. That's what we're all about. That's what libraries are all about. So if you value this vital institution as much as I do, please consider making a donation to the Free Library Foundation. The foundation supports many of the library's incredible programs, like tonight's author events. So visit freelibrary.org to make your gift today. That's my promotion for the night. And it's my pleasure now to talk about tonight's author. Award-winning writer and philosopher Rebecca Goldstein examines the conflicts between heart and mind and how reason and emotion construct the totality of who we are. Her award-winning books include the novels The Mind-Body Problem, Properties of Light, and 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, and she has nonfiction studies of Kurt Gödel and Baruch Spinoza. She is a member of the American Academy of the Arts and Sciences, a Guggenheim Fellow, and a winner of a prestigious MacArthur Fellowship. In her new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Goldstein places Plato within a 21st century dialogic context, exploring modern debates about politics, religion, science, and ethics, and the monumental questions that continue to puzzle us. According to Publishers Weekly, the book is both an enjoyable and a serious way to relearn Plato's ideas. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Rebecca Goldstein to the Free Library. Rebecca.
Thank you very much for that, and thank you all for coming out on this very cold day. It's colder here than in Boston. It is. I wasn't expecting this. Anyway, today is my official pub date, so I know you haven't read my book. Thank you. and I thought I would tell you a little bit about it. I actually wanted to first say something about libraries, because I came from a family, we didn't own any books. We were poor. It was hard enough for my family to put clothes on all of our backs, and we were a very religious family. And every Friday before the Sabbath, we would be taken, my siblings and I, to the public library, and we would get the reading for the Sabbath because, frankly, we weren't allowed to do much else than read on those Sabbaths. And I really, you know, got an education in that library. My parents, as religious as they were, allowed us to read freely as long as it wasn't, you know, dirty. We were allowed to read whatever we wanted. I think my mother rued that in my case when I became so enamored of philosophy. But, in fact, it was from a book that I got out of the library that I first heard the name Plato. And it was my first experience with a kind of ecstasy. The book was Will Durant's The Story of Philosophy, and which was, I think, a bestseller in its day. And I got it out. And I know that I didn't understand very much of what I read, but there was something about the Plato chapter that just got me so excited that at a certain point I had to like put the book down because my head was racing so much. And it was that vision of beyond all of the chaos and the confusion, there was a perfect order, that the senses lie, and there is something graspable by the mind that is perfect and eternal and mathematical. I was a kid who loved math. And that vision of truth, beauty, and goodness beyond confusion just, you know, it just did it for me. Confusion was probably my most common experience. I'd spent all of my life as a child, right? And children are confused. So Plato and I go way back. And it's in some sense strange to me that it's taken me, this is actually my 10th book, it's taken me all of these books to write about Plato. But that's really not so strange because everybody's written about Plato, right? Starting with Aristotle, his student, right? He got right to work attacking Plato. And, well, I mean, what else are graduate students for, right? But, so we've had 2,400 years of going at Plato, interpreting Plato. Many, many different Platos have been offered to us. And so when I thought about writing about Plato, I knew I didn't want to do it in the way that it's been done before. And in fact, my whole career has been trying to find different ways of writing about philosophy, sometimes using novels, sometimes going straight for the philosophical argument. So I wanted to use Plato in a way to tackle an issue that's become increasingly on my mind. I spend a lot of time with scientists. Before I went into philosophy, I had intended to be a physicist, and graduated with a degree in physics. And then went into philosophy of science. And I spend a lot of time, I'm very comfortable with scientists. I spend a lot of time with scientists. And one of the things that scientists are always, or I hear so much is, oh, philosophy, you never make any progress, you know. That's where your interest is in Plato. That's ridiculous, you know, that a philosopher who lived 2,400 years ago is still of interest to you. That shows how little progress is made in philosophy. And so I hear this all the time, and I think it's dead wrong. It's a cliche that philosophy doesn't make progress, and I think it's actually wrong. Philosophy does make progress. It's the kind of progress we don't see because we see with it. It changes our points of view. And I thought, I'm going to try to use Plato, strangely enough, paradoxically enough, to argue how far we've gotten. That Plato, we've left him in the dust. He would be very, very surprised about many things. And that's partly what I do in the book. I have Platonic dialogues, and it's Plato back in our day talking to us about some of our issues. The other thing I wanted to do, though, was I wanted to get closer to Plato. He's so remote, right? And it's not just that he lived 2,400 years ago. We know a lot more about other characters who lived back then, many of whom Plato wrote about. We know more about Socrates because of not just Plato, but others who wrote about him, but because of the way Socrates figures in Plato's dialogues. Plato is very aloof from us because of the means he chose to write, which was the dialogue form. And so it's characters who are talking, and it's very hard to hear Plato through the various characters. Those points of view are so enlivened. They're so embedded in characters. He's a wonderful artist, as we all know, besides being a great philosopher. And it's almost the same problem as with Shakespeare. You know, like, where is Shakespeare in the midst of all of these points of view that are so enlivened by characters? And, you know, like any lover, and I guess I do love Plato still, I wanted to get closer to Plato and wanted to find a means of doing that. And so part of the book goes back into ancient Greece and tries to examine once again that culture and ask why it gave rise to someone like Plato, who really created philosophy as it exists. What was it about that extraordinary culture that gave us not only philosophy, but science, abstract mathematics, the study of history, what else? Great art, timeless art, right? Drama, architecture, sculpture. I mean, they, you know, talk about overachievers of these, I mean, you know, democracy, Western civilization, right? What was it? And basically, in 200 years, they went from anime and illiteracy to Aeschylus and Aristotle. I mean, this is pretty extraordinary, what was going on there. So that was part of it. But I'm trying to get closer to Plato. But also, I moonlight as a novelist, right? I trained as a philosopher, but I moonlight as a novelist. And one of the things that one is trained to do as a novelist is to create characters. And when you really have a character going, it takes a while to really get a character going. When you have a character going, you hear them. You hear their voice very clearly. It's not quite like taking dictation. I do know novelists who, lucky them, say, yeah, they just hear it and they're note takers. They just take it down. It's not like that for me. It's somewhere in between, halfway in between taking dictation and just making up words to put in a character's mouth. There's somewhere in between there. And so what I wanted to do was to really be able to hear Plato as a character. I had to, of course, basically memorize all the dialogues so that when a phrase, when a passage was relevant, I would know where to weave it in. But I also had to have a character whose words I could judge as being, you know, right or wrong or, you know, in character, out of character, just exactly what one does when one creates a character as a novel. A little bit, I think, like what Plato did with Socrates, right? When Plato wrote those dialogues, most of which, 25 of the 26 dialogues, feature Socrates. Socrates was dead. He had been executed by the Athenian democracy. And it, Plato says in the seventh letter, if that is veridical, that's what convinced him to turn to philosophy, the execution of Socrates. Plato, we know very, very little about him, but one thing I think we really know is that he loved Socrates. And I think perhaps by making Socrates the central to the exposition of his own philosophy, by bringing Socrates along with him as Plato became a philosopher of genius with his own ideas, but bringing Socrates along with him, this was a kind of act of love to create this character. It was a way of keeping the beloved voice with him and having his own ideas flow through that voice. And I wanted to do something like that for Plato in these dialogues. But mostly I wanted to use Plato to test this view that philosophy has made progress, that Plato, were he to come back now, would be surprised by many of the things that we know, not just scientifically, obviously, our technology, but philosophically as well, ethically as well, politically as well. What? No slaves, right? It wouldn't occur to Plato to question slavery. In fact, the idea of individual rights really did not exist in the ancient Greek world. It's really, we owe that to the Enlightenment. Anyway, so that was the idea. What was the character that I came up with in these dialogues? Well, Plato is, as I say, I try to weave many of the things he actually did say. He's very, very serious. He's very earnest, rather formal, but quite playful as well. He is always open to other points of view, but he probes them intensely. He's not a stranger to sadness, and I think that is certainly true of the historical Plato. But he's also knows the consolations of thought, and he's insatiably curious. One of the first places I take him to is the Googleplex, I've spoken at the Googleplex, and I will be speaking again at the Googleplex in a few weeks. And he gets a computer there. He gets a Chromebook, and he's really excited. That was very good for me because, one, he gets brought up to speed really quickly, right? He's constantly consulting the internet. But also he's at first extremely excited at the potentials for knowledge, and perhaps even wisdom, that he sees in the internet, and he quickly becomes disillusioned, especially when I bring him on Fox News. extremely disillusioned by the new technology not opening people up to other points of view, but in fact balkanizing points of view. Everybody sort of going to sources that agree with them and getting their knowledge or their information that way. Anyway, that is what I do. I have him at the Googleplex. He gets into a conversation with his media escort there who's telling the story, Cheryl, and a software engineer. And the topic of the discussion becomes, can ethics be crowdsourced? You can imagine how keen Plato would be about such an idea, that crowdsourcing ethics. And I next have him at the 92nd Street Y on a panel of child experts on how to raise the exceptional child, right? And he's with somebody I call a warrior mother. you might call her a tiger mother, and a psychoanalyst. And then the question quickly becomes, as Plato would want it to be, ought we to want to raise exceptional children? Should that be the focus of our parenting? And I don't give him an easy time. I mean, the people really do argue back with him a lot. That psychotherapist is really, she's vicious. The next place I take him to is, he has a lot to say about love and sex, you know, the symposium, the Phaedrus is my favorite, of the dialogues. I believe that Plato was in love when he wrote that dialogue. And I have him being the consultant to an advice columnist who is in fact a friend of mine, Margot Howard, who is wrote as Dear Prudence for many years. She herself is the daughter of Ann Landers and the niece of Abby, Dear Abby. So advice columns are in her blood. And she often consults experts, as her mother did, and she often consults me when she thinks a question is philosophical. She gets a lot of questions about people losing faith in God, and she always consults me then. And I decided to make Plato be one of her consultants, and I made up questions, and they were questions to which Plato would have an answer. They came from mostly the Symposium and the Phaedrus, Plato's questions, the kind of questions I knew Plato would have an answer to, and I wrote them out and sent them to Margot, and then she gave her advice, and then she consulted Plato. And here's the interesting thing. Plato was often more liberal than Margot was. So, for example, the first question, I think, it came from a graduate student in one of those job-drained humanities fields, and her professor had offered to be a professor with benefits. She sleeps with him, he'll help her get a job, should she do it. Well, those of you who have read the Phaedrus know that there's actually something that is very, very relevant in there. And so Plato has something to answer, but lots and lots of, actually, I think there are about 12 such questions. And then he goes on to Fox News. And the last of the dialogues is Plato volunteers to get a brain scan, to go into an fMRI, and for a scientific experiment, the same one that I volunteered for. I couldn't write about it unless I did it, clearly. And he gets into a discussion with two neuroscientists about whether or not neuroscience has solved the problem of free will and of moral agency. So these are all, and I could really weave things that he said. And if I didn't footnote them, I don't think you would be able to tell what are the things that I actually took from Plato and what are the things that I'm putting into his mouth. He's constantly being surprised, but he's also has things to say that are relevant. I don't know if I'll convince any scientists that philosophy has made progress, but that was in fact the goal. I thought, if there's time, I'd read just a little to you. But I'm going to take a vote, because this is my first reading, so I don't know what to read, frankly. I could read a little from Plato at the 92nd Street Y, or I could read a little from Plato in the magnet. That's what neuroscientists call an fMRI, the magnet, because it works by way of a giant magnet. And man, is it noisy. Any of you who have ever had a scan know it's extremely noisy. Anyway, how many would you want Plato at the Y? Yeah? Okay. Fox News. I didn't even think. That's so complicated, I don't know where I would even begin. Okay, let's do, how many, the fMRI? Huh. Maybe I'll do both. I'll do a little from Plato at the Y. So here's the invitation. Bringing together the country's foremost thought leaders, educators, and experts to exchange ideas and inspire action in the global community, the 92nd Street YMYWHA is a hub for innovative discussion that informs, influences, and drives our culture forward. Join us at the Y for what promises to be the highlight of the season. Zachary Burns, beloved columnist for the newspaper of record, will lead a discussion on how to raise an exceptional child. With Zach will be best-selling author Mitzi Munitz, author of Esteeming Your Child, how even the best-intentioned parents violate, mutilate, and desecrate their children. Sophie Z., best-selling author of the Warrior Mother's Guide to Producing Off-the-Charts Children, and Plato, best-selling author of The Republic. All right. Burns. I want to thank all of you in the audience for coming out on this blustery, snowy evening. It's a real testament to these three outstanding panelists up here on stage with me that not only is there not a single empty seat in the room, but we've had to accommodate the large overflow audience in additional rooms where they're watching the discussion on closed-circuit TV. But it's no wonder that so many would brave a blizzard to hear tonight's exchange. Not only are we privileged to have with us three internationally acclaimed authors who have written extensively and controversially on the subject of child rearing, but the subject itself is one that's guaranteed to provoke visceral reactions. It doesn't require the meme of the selfish gene to remind us that every generation is heavily invested in wanting their children to do well in life. What my own grandparents used to call Naches von der Kinder, Naches from the kids. Wait a minute. Do I need to translate Naches? It's Yiddish, and there's no exact English equivalent. Anyone? Z, the warrior mother. Doesn't it mean the pride that parents feel in the achievements of their children? Burns laughing. You really are an overachiever, aren't you? Z laughing. Well, I'm married to a Jewish man. I have a Jewish mother-in-law. Audience laughter. Z smiles radiantly. Burns, that's Sophie Z, folks, and it's my privilege as moderator for tonight's event to formally introduce her and her fellow panelists. Of course, they're all so accomplished that if I were even to begin to do justice to their resumes, we would have to camp out here all night, which, given the weather forecast, we may have to do anyway. Still, I know you're eager to hear from them, so I'll limit myself to the high points, particularly those that apply to tonight's discussion. I, by the way, am Zach Burns, a lowly journalist. Dr. Mitzi Munitz, sitting immediately to my left, was born in Vienna, where she trained as a psychoanalyst, although after 20 years of practice, she renounced psychoanalysis as colluding in the same vicious power structure of exploitative parenting as the rest of society does. Dr. Munitz's ideas have profoundly changed the culture of child rearing, heightening our recognition of the more subtle forms that the victimization of children can take and encouraging people to look back on their own childhoods in search of the abuse they may have suffered. One critic has described Dr. Munitz as, quote, the missing link between Freud and Oprah. Esteeming Your Child, which has sold a whopping 800,000 copies, Munitz, I'm not going to try a Viennese accent, but imagine. Munitz, my apologies, Mr. Moderator, but here I must correct you. Esteeming Your Child has sold 1 million copies to date and been translated into more than 30 languages. Burns, Esteeming Your Child, which has sold a truly whopping 1 million copies, will be on sale after tonight's event, together with Dr. Munitz's most recent book, Post-Traumatic Distress Disorder, Another Name for Life. Seated to the right of Dr. Munitz is Sophie Z. Professor Z is a first-generation American who was born in Palo Alto, California, and attended Stanford University and then went on to Stanford Law School, where she is now the Fraucus Professor of Law. Professor Z is the author of several learned books and case studies, but the book that catapulted her to international fame is The Warrior Mother's Guide to Producing Off-the-Chart Children. Talk about controversy. This book ignited a firestorm, not just coast to coast, but all around the world. Munitz. Excuse me, but I must again interrupt, since despite this international notoriety that you are describing, I remain unfamiliar with this author and her work, and must ask whether the title was intended as satire, because it does not seem possible that after my groundbreaking discoveries concerning the psychopathology of everyday parenting, that anybody could, in earnest seriousness, put forth in a non-ironic mode such a thesis as seems suggested by a literal reading of this title. Burns. You see, ladies and gentlemen, I didn't lie to you. I promised you controversy, and we've got controversy before I've even finished the introductions. Let's hold off having Professor Z answer your question, Dr. Muniz, at least until we get through with these preliminaries. Professor Z was recently chosen as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world, Muniz muttering, ugh, too bad for the world, Burns, and of course her book will be available for sale and signing immediately after our event. And now I turn to our last panelist, Plato. It's just Plato, isn't it? Not Dr. Plato? Plato, that's right. Burns, but of course you've been teaching for most of your professional life, so I suppose it's only right to call you Professor Plato. Plato. Plato would be sufficient. Plato is what I'm called. Burns. Plato it is then. Plato has long been hailed as one of the most creative and influential thinkers in the history of Western thought. Indeed, some have argued that all of philosophy consists of footnotes to Plato, which is high praise indeed. He was born in Athens, Greece, a city where he has spent the bulk of his life and where he informally studied as a young man under the famous philosopher Socrates. Plato was so impressed with Socrates' thinking, even though, as I understand it, Socrates never published a single book or journal article, that he abandoned his hopes of becoming a dramatist and poet and instead became a philosopher. I think Dr. Muniz may have some questions to put to you regarding your parents' reactions to those two choices, poetry and philosophy. Muniz, I do indeed have many urgent questions to put to Plato, not only concerning his parents. Plato presents to me as a classic case of intellectualization in order to cauterize the deep wounds inflicted during his impressionable early life. Burns, in good time, Dr. Muniz, in good time. This is just the introductions. I'll read you just a little bit further on when they get into it. Burns. Well, this is fascinating, ladies and gentlemen, because both Professor Z and Dr. Muniz have appealed to Plato's work in support of their own very divergent views. This highlights what I said in introducing Plato tonight, that everybody likes to trace their ideas back to him, happy to be counted among his footnotes. So after hearing Professor Z cite you and Dr. Muniz cite you, let us finally turn to you, Plato, and let you speak for yourself. Plato, and where would you like me to begin? Burns, a good question. Well, why don't we begin with the projectification of the child that Dr. Muniz referred to? While she was speaking, I couldn't help thinking of the intense program of child-rearing that you lay out in the Republic. You're as hands-on as any warrior mother, discussing everything from the kinds of bedtime stories little children should be told to dictating what subjects ought to be studied in school and even which extracurricular activities should be encouraged. As I remember, you agree with Professor Z that drama club is definitely out while music is in, though you two sharply disagree over sports. Sophie, you aren't at all enthusiastic that your kids participate in sports, while you, Plato, make athletics very central in raising the perfect child. Plato, both music and athletics are essential since they have opposing but ameliorative influences on the developing child. Muniz, on all children? Plato, well, I mostly confined myself to a certain subclass of children, Muniz. Yes, the elite, the only ones who truly count in your estimation. Plato, I would not say so. Muniz, no, I'm sure you wouldn't say so. Anyway, it goes on, and that's all I'm going to read to you. Should I read a little of the, or, yeah? Okay. Dr. David Choquette, a neuroscientist at prestigious Olympia University. Choquette employs functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, a brain scanning technology using radio waves and a huge ring-shaped magnet to study the mesolimbic dopaminergic pathway in highly impulsive individuals. He has shown that the brains of such people, who often end up as addicts and felons, are flooded with dopamine, so they experience intense cravings, while their prefrontal cortex, the seat of higher order mental processes, including self-control, remains minimally activated, so they cannot control these cravings. Agatha Fine, a third-year graduate student working in Choquette's lab. Plato, philosopher and author visiting Olympia on the U.S. leg of his book tour. Interested in the new developments in cognitive and affective neuroscience, Plato has volunteered to have his brain scanned as part of the control group for Choquette's research. Choquette walks into a windowless conference room. Agatha is sitting at a small round table, filling in paperwork. Choquette. Okay, Agatha, anything I should know before we get started? Agatha, with barely contained excitement. The subject is Plato. Choquette. What are the stats? Agatha, male Caucasian, highly educated, born in Greece, but fluent in English, 2,400 years old. He's already signed the release forms. Also, he asked whether he might have a copy of his scan to take home with him. Do you think we could make an exception, Dr. Choquette, considering whose brain it is? Choquette, out of the question. The guy discovers he has a tumor or swollen artery that he thinks we should have told him about, and next thing we know, he's coming back all lawyered up. Wait a minute. Did you say the subject is 2,400 years old? He whistles contemplatively. Did he even know what he was signing? Agatha, it's Plato, the famous philosopher. I read a ton of him in college. Choquette, live and learn. I didn't even know there were philosophers still running around. They have them on the faculty here at Olympia? Agatha, of course. Choquette, do they share the same building with the astrologers and the alchemists? Choquette laughs loudly, and Agatha smiles wanly. Choquette's laugh is reminiscent of the mating call of the male elephant seal. Plato enters wearing the blue scrubs that all subjects are required to wear in the magnet. Choquette, I'm Dr. Choquette, and I hear that you're a philosopher, dabbling in a bit of alchemy on the side. Plato, alchemy? Have I wandered into the wrong laboratory then? Choquette, good Lord, I wasn't talking about me. Plato, no, of course not. In fact, your research interests me very much. Choquette, smiling sardonically and trying to catch Agatha's eye. Is that a fact? Plato, it is. I have read several of your papers. My amygdala made me do it. How neuroscience eliminates right and wrong. There's nobody home. How neuroscience eliminates the self. Am I out of the loop? How neuroscience eliminates free will. Choquette, those are three of my best. Plato, no doubt. Nevertheless, I couldn't follow you all the way to your conclusions. Choquette, hardly surprising. You follow me to my conclusions and you're not only out of the loop, you're out of a job. Morality, the self, free will, didn't you guys used to think you own those topics? Plato, and now the ownership has passed over to you. Choquette, here's the way I see it. In the old days, before science had caught up, a person had a question, he went to his local philosopher. Do we have souls, they asked him. And if we do, how do they interact with our bodies? What's the source of morality, they asked him. And how do we know whether the version we have is the right one? What's the story on beauty? Is it in the eyes of the beholder, or is it something really out there? And what about meanings? Are they out there too, and how do they attach themselves to sentences and words? Oh, and while you're at it, could you tell us whether our lives have any meaning? And if so, how we can get us some? I bet people have even asked you these questions. Plato, they have. Choquette, and I bet you struggled to give them answers. Plato, I did. I do. Choquette, of course you did. Nobody had the data, so people went to the guy who could talk up a storm around some fine-sounding conclusion, even though the philosopher a few villages over was talking up a storm in support of an altogether different conclusion. Plato, and now you have the data that will silence the talk storms. Choquette, I bet you're wishing you'd run into me about 2,400 years or so sooner. I could have saved you a lot of wasted effort, not to speak of words. Plato, we didn't have any of your wonderful science 2,400 years ago. Choquette, that's true. Be glad that you've lived to see it. Plato, I am. But even had we the science back then, you wouldn't have turned me away from the life I've chosen and from the questions that have shaped it. I wouldn't have wanted to live my life in any other way. Choquette, that's nice, but I've scanned the brains of felons who would say exactly the same thing. The rush of dopamine they get when they contemplate certain pleasurable possibilities means they can't even consider living their lives in any other way. It goes on. It goes on. Plato believes in free will. and he believes in moral agency. I gave it away. That's some of the book. That's some of the fun I have with it. And happy for your questions.
I enjoyed your presentation very much.
Thank you.
I must first begin with a disclaimer. I'm not by no means a philosopher. But the whole world of ideas would not be accessible in the first place if we did not have a brain which is based on physical mechanisms and the whole powerful force of natural selection. We would not have a mind, and there would be nothing to think about.
Sure.
So can you comment on why that is not the basic premise of all philosophy? I mean, why has that been minimized by and large?
I don't think it has.
The whole field of neurophilosophy, the whole field of neurophilosophy, and that's just, it's just starting out. And
yeah.
It just seems kind of strange that it's not been...
Well, actually, I think it has. One of the reasons, I think, that... what's the subtitle of the book? Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. Why Philosophy Won't Go Away is... one of the major roles of philosophy is to take very, very seriously the scientific image of people, of us in the world, and to reconcile it with, I'm actually using a philosopher here, his terminology, it's Wilfred Sellers, to reconcile the scientific image of us in the world, which we must take seriously, with what Sellers called the manifest image, the other image that we have of ourselves in the world, or for example, as agents, as people, making decisions. This is very, very hard to give up and pursue a life. How do we reconcile that with the latest findings in neuroscience? Philosophy always has to take seriously the latest findings in science. That's part of its job, is to try to reconcile those notions that we, or the image that we get from science, with other notions that we need in order to pursue our lives. And see, sometimes they're irreconcilable. I would say at this point, the notion of a disembodied soul is irreconcilable with science as we now know it. With evolution, with neuroscience, it's extremely hard to take seriously, as former centuries of philosophers took seriously, the notion of a disembodied soul. Here is something that is extraordinary to me. We always think of Plato as, you know, having believed in this disembodied soul. In what I think is his greatest work, the Timaeus, he's a materialist. He's actually a materialist. He actually thinks that the mind is the brain. He actually says the brain. His student Aristotle located the mind in the heart. He got it wrong. Plato actually located it in the brain, and he goes even further and says something amazing. When I'm in New York this week, I'm going to be talking on stage with the neuroscientist Antonio Damasio, and he's also somebody who takes Spinoza's very seriously, so we've had a lot of conversations together. But I can't wait to read to him side by side with what he says about the mind and about holding people, that we can't hold people whose minds are diseased responsible for their actions, with what Plato actually says in the Timaeus. He actually has this extremely progressive idea there that... Well, he always thought that nobody does bad willingly. Very optimistic view. That if people know the good, they will do it. And so when people are evil, there must be something wrong with their brains, and so we should, you know, get them out of the way and maybe try to cure their brains, but we can't hold them morally responsible. That is incredible. That is such a progressive idea, and it completely parrots something that Damasio says. I can't wait to read this to him. So anyway, he is, for his time, I mean, a lot of his, the other thing that's really interesting, and here too with the Timaeus, is he kind of lays out the groundwork for mathematical physics. He really, this is why Galileo and Kepler always referred to him as the divine Plato. He really thinks that the way to make nature intelligible is to get at mathematics, and not only to get at mathematics, but to get at the most beautiful mathematics. Nature will choose the most beautiful mathematics. This is a working principle we use still in physics. So, but anyway, so even Plato sort of had, there's a kind of materialist view that's there, but I would say at this point, philosophers, very few of them take seriously, for reasons that you have mentioned, notions of disembodied soul, and philosophers always have to take science, which is our best way of knowing the world, very, very seriously.
It's 2,400 years later, and Plato goes to the 92nd Street Y, which I think is hysterical and brilliant. And my question is, what happened in all that time to the ontological status of numbers? Do they have an existence outside the mind of the mathematician or the mathematical physicist for the author of the Timaeus and so on and so forth?
Yeah. So, the one time that you really hear the word Platonism in contemporary philosophy, the one time that that word comes up over and over and over again, is in philosophy of mathematics. In fact, I was speaking before to people here, and I heard that Jim Holt had just been here. And Jim Holt is who wrote, what did he write? Why is there something rather than nothing, or something like that. I have this email from him, and he was auditing some math class with great mathematicians, great logicians, stellar names, and he said we couldn't get anywhere because controversies over Platonism rage the whole time. And that controversy that you are talking about that is the controversy you just named. Are numbers real? We use them. We use them to describe what's real in physics. But what is the, as you put it, their ontological status? Plato, as he formulated most of the paradigmatic questions of all these different fields. And he did formulate that when he believed, yes, they have an ontological, independent ontological status, but we are still arguing over that one, right? It is, they did a survey of mathematicians, members of the AMA, and 95% of them were Platonists, believed in the independent real, that they are discovering, they are not inventing, that these truths have an independent status. That's really, for me, you know, that's just a really good question. I have a book on Gödel's incompleteness theorems, and Gödel was a passionate Platonist. He really believed that math was, you know, independent discovery. These truths exist, and they're there to be discovered. And I think I have good evidence that this is what motivated his mathematical work, the incompleteness theorems. He wanted a mathematical result that would prove something meta-mathematically, prove Platonism. But it is one of those questions that Plato put on the table, and it's still there. No. Yeah. And actually, that is one of the questions that I flip on constantly. You know, ask me a different time of day. I'm a Platonist when it comes to math or not. I don't like it. It's too mysterious. I don't like mystery, but it's hard to do away with. Yes, please.
So I was thinking about Spike Jonze's movie Her and about machines with souls, and what would Plato say or you about that?
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie yet. I really should. It sounds like a really philosophical movie. We are material things. There is some mechanism that is making us who we are. We haven't quite figured it out yet. But we are, you know, we are machines. We happen to be made out of the stuff we're made out of. But it's the hardware doesn't matter. It's the software that matters. So I'm down with the premise of Her. Plato? Yeah. I think so. You know, based on what he says on the Timaeus, I think he would be.
One of the things you said at the beginning was Plato would be surprised at the progress we have made. And I'm curious about the word progress, because all the things that you mentioned is we would think of progress. I'm not sure Plato would have thought of as progress. And I'm not sure what he would have understood as progress. And I'm not even sure what I think of what is progress, except that wherever I am is always better than where we were. I'm not sure what you mean by that, and whether Plato would have had an idea of something going beyond him.
Yeah. He begins it, actually. In the Republic, he has an argument that even in war, you can't treat other Greeks any old way you want. You can't take them as slaves. You can't rape their women. And so he sort of, you know, begins this process of expanding the notion of, you know, what you can do to those who are outside of your group. Peter Singer in The Expanding Circle credits Plato, actually, with having made the first step, you know, that he expanded it and said, you know, Athenians can't, you know, treat Spartans, or Spartans can't treat Athenians or Corinthians, you know, as any old way that they can, you know, that they want to. And that was a beginning. What I would say, you know, philosophy has done was to try to look at the grounds that we have for when we think that a certain behavior is wrong, certain commitments that we already have, see what the logic is there, and then see if that logic applies to other cases as well. So whatever it was that Plato was seeing, that you can't treat other Greeks, would that apply also to barbarians, to what they call the barbarians, right? Anybody who's not Greek was a barbarian because their language sounded like bar, 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 right? Blah, blah, blah. So that's where the word barbarian comes from. Isolating the logic of, you know, commitments that we already have, and then seeing if the same logic applies and expanding it. That is one of the most important things that philosophers have done. And so the same logic, you know, applies, it was seen, you know, to slaves, to the colonized, to women, to children, to the handicapped. We're seeing it happen right now, the arguments about gay rights. We're seeing it about the arguments about animal rights. When Peter Singer started to write about the heinous things that we do to animals, this was about 35 years ago, everybody thought he was kind of nuts. Those arguments slowly, slowly have infiltrated and are making people feel guilty. And I think that my grandchildren, should I ever be so lucky to have them, will We'll look back on the way that, you know, our factory farming and be appalled, the way we look back at slavery and are appalled. How could they not have seen this? Somehow it takes us a very long time to see this. One of the interesting things is it always begins with arguments, just as Peter Singer began it, with an argument, with an abstract argument saying, look, you know, if you have these, if you already have these ethical commitments, don't they imply something further? So looking at the implications of commitments we already have is one of the jobs of philosophers, and it has made a difference. I mean, it can't be accomplished by arguments alone. It takes working on the emotions as well. I always say, paraphrasing Kant, you know, arguments without emotions are empty, but emotions without arguments are blind. So it takes both of these working together. But the arguments are there, and they're usually, you know, they're philosophical arguments. So that's the kind of progress that I'm talking about. I don't think any of us would want to go back. As extraordinary as those Greeks were, none of us would want to go back and live in that time. Certainly not as a woman would I want to go back and live at that time. So I call that progress. It means more lives, not just human lives, let's hope animal lives too, are flourishing. And that's progress. Yes.
I've been waiting. Great. I get the last question. This is fabulous. So much to say. But talk about Cheryl a little bit for me. Based on what you just said now, I saw Cheryl, I think it was Cheryl, who's the character who argues that it's not just arguments, it's feelings.
Yes.
I think it's in the Googleplex. Is that argument identified with Cheryl there, that last thing you just said? Is she the person that advocates that it's not just reason, it has to get into your feelings before there's a change?
Yes, I think it does. It's we are very inertial creatures. We do not like to change our minds, especially when it's in our self-interest. And it's always in the self-interest of those who are in power that minds not be changed. And so arguments alone can't do it. There has to be emotions. Empathy has to be brought into it. There have to be arguments that make room for empathy, you know, that argue that these are creatures, women, children, you know, people of other races, creatures who are worthy of empathy. You need that, but that, you know, to open up the channels of empathy. But yes, emotions have to be brought into it, which is in fact one of the reasons why I'm so committed to writing about philosophy in the form of fiction. Fiction allows you to bring in emotions, to work on emotions. And I think that is absolutely important. And I think that Plato recognizes
that.
That's what
I was going to ask you. Do you see that
Plato?
Because I don't.
I do because of the care with which this artistry is made. This is great art, and he has these points of view embedded in characters whose way of acting, whose way of being in the world, represents their point of view. You know, Callicles, my favorite character in the Gorgias, you know, he's an asshole, right? He believes that right makes that might makes right, and he acts that way at the Themistocles in the first book of the Republic. So he's taking care. It's not just the arguments. I'm trained as an analytic philosopher too. I taught Plato when I taught him. Let's go for the argument. Let's, you know, formalize the argument. Where are the premises? What's wrong? What, you know, where are the hidden premises? Plato is much more than that. He did banish the artists from his utopia. I'll never forgive him for that. But he thought they were irresponsible. They were not philosophical enough, right? He was trying to show us how to do philosophically responsible art. And I think one of the reasons I'm not a best-selling novelist is I'm always trying to live up to his standards. I'm always trying to think, would Plato approve of this? If Plato approves of what you write, you're not necessarily going to be a bestseller. Not that. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.